KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Nobody was texting war plans, and that's all I have to say about that. Right, thank you.
The fallout continues after messages from a national security group chat got leaked. For Saturday, March 29th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Emily Kwong. Some good news: drug overdose deaths in the U.S. are dropping at a pace so rapid, even the public health community is surprised.
We're now seeing states where drug deaths are dropping 50% in a single year. So many lives being saved.
Plus, the invention of the shopping cart in Oklahoma, and how the erasure of non-white history is playing out under the Trump administration.
If you take away pictures of Black heroes, of Asians, of Native Americans, of Latinos, then who's left?
First news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In Myanmar, the state-run media says more than 1,600 people were killed after yesterday's earthquake in the center of the country. Thousands of others were injured. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake was a magnitude 7.7. Myanmar's military is now allowing international aid to help in the aftermath. Michael Sullivan has more from neighboring Thailand.
The first shipments of international aid arrived this morning at the airport in the former capital, Yangon. They came from neighboring China and from India and included search and rescue and medical teams, as well as blankets and other provisions. But the epicenter of the quake was just outside Myanmar's second biggest city, Mandalay, some 360 miles to the north by road. The airport there remains closed. Rescue workers say their efforts have been stymied by a lack of equipment and personnel, with some resorting to digging with their hands. In neighboring Thailand, rescue workers used heavy equipment to try to rescue dozens of construction workers trapped in the rubble after a 33-story skyscraper under construction collapsed. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
Employees at the U.S. Institute of Peace are being fired en masse. And NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports it's happening weeks after the Trump administration's government efficiency team took over the building that houses the nonprofit think tank.
Starting late Friday night, the USIP HR department told most employees their jobs have been terminated. The U.S. Institute of Peace is a think tank funded by Congress, but the workers are not federal employees. Though the institute owns its own building and has a large endowment funded in part by private donors, the Trump administration is trying to take it over. The board members fired by Trump are suing the administration. Employees have until early April to turn in their badges and computers. They were notified over private email addresses since they haven't had access to their official accounts since the Trump administration brought in a new president earlier this month. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Activists are protesting at hundreds of Tesla showrooms around the world today, including at a showroom in New York City.
Oh, oh, Elon Musk has got to go.
They're showing their anger at the role that the billionaire Elon Musk has taken in the Trump administration. The protests have been going on for weeks, drawing dozens to a few hundred people at different locations. Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency team gained access to sensitive data and have shut down entire agencies as he tries to reduce the size and scope of the federal workforce. The Tesla takedown movement says Musk is destroying democracy. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth attended a wreath-laying ceremony to commemorate today's 80th anniversary of the World War II Battle of Iwo Jima. Hegseth visited the Pacific Island alongside Japan's prime minister and his Japanese counterpart. He honored the fallen troops and those still alive who are at the ceremony today. Hegseth was in Manila yesterday, where he met with top Philippine leaders. Could a lightning strike have created life on Earth? NPR's Regina Barber reports on how Stanford University researchers are giving this old question some new energy.
In 1953, scientists Stanley Miller and Harold Urey filled a glass bulb with methane, water vapor, ammonia, and other atmospheric gases, and then zapped those gases with an electric spark. This reaction created amino acids, the chemical building blocks of life. That experiment made some scientists wonder if a bigger spark, like lightning, could have started life on Earth. But lightning is rare, which is why other researchers favor different starting points, like hydrothermal vents or an asteroid enriched with organic material. But now a study in the journal Science Advances may have found a more common source of electricity, called microlightning. These tiny sparks are produced when water droplets separate and get oppositely charged. Microlightning may occur all over nature, giving an old hypothesis new life. Regina Barber, NPR News.
In women's NCAA college basketball action, South Carolina defeated Maryland last night, and tomorrow the Gamecocks play Duke, with the winner advancing to the women's Final Four in Tampa. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Emily Kwong in for Scott Detrow. It's been another nonstop week in politics, with executive orders almost daily, court rulings both blocking and paving the way for Trump administration priorities, and the fallout is still coming from the national security group chat that spilled into public view. President Trump is in Florida this weekend, and as a result, so is NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who joins us now. Hi, Tam.
Hi there.
Hi. Okay. The group chat a reporter was accidentally invited to got many of the headlines this week. Where does that stand at this point?
So far, no one involved in the group chat has resigned or been fired. Trump allies are downplaying it. But the drip, drip, drip keeps coming. The White House was so insistent that the information shared in the chat wasn't classified that Atlantic editor Jeffrey Goldberg, who had been added to the chat, ended up publishing the entire contents of the chat. That included details about a bombing attack on Houthi rebels in Yemen hours before it happened. There were also details that gave hints at the kind of intelligence the U.S. had about the targets. The Trump administration is digging in for now, saying no harm, no foul. The mission was successful. But the top Republican and Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee have formally requested an inquiry by the acting inspector general at the Department of Defense.
Okay. It is almost impossible to keep track of all the legal challenges to Trump administration policies. And this week, there was a lot of action in court. What stands out to you?
For the White House, the courts are proving to be a real speed bump. And it's not clear yet whether some of these challenges may also turn out to be roadblocks. In the case of Trump's effort to use the Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelans to a prison in El Salvador without a hearing, an appeals court ruled against the administration this week. The White House says they are appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court, and a spokesman said that it should, quote, shock the conscience of the American people and constitutes capitulation to the ongoing unauthorized infringement on the president's authority to protect the American people. So that is how the White House is seeing it. But other court rulings this week allowed the administration to move ahead with dissolving USAID and firing certain federal workers. So it has really been something of a mixed bag.
Tam, let's talk about the president's executive orders and other actions from this week. Do you see a theme developing?
It does extend beyond this week, but there is a concerted and sustained effort by the president to bend American institutions to his will. There was an executive order demanding that the Smithsonian Museums represent a more positive, unblemished view of American history. There's a continued push to get universities to comply with his wishes to crack down on campus protests and ditch diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. And there were more orders this week going after big law firms that once employed people that Trump blames for what he calls the witch hunts against him. These orders are a direct threat to the ability of these firms to represent their clients. Some of the firms are fighting it. Some are coming to agreements with the president, and it is roiling the legal profession.
Meanwhile, President Trump has been previewing Liberation Day on April 2nd. What does he mean by that?
Well, he's talking about tariffs, and he plans to institute reciprocal tariffs on imports from countries all over the world, though we don't know which ones exactly. We don't have a lot of clarity on the specifics. Some of his top economic advisors did fly down to Florida with him last night on Air Force One. Reporters were asking the president about whether he sees himself negotiating on these tariffs, and he said yes, but probably not until after they are announced. So while all eyes will be on the specifics he announces on Wednesday, don't assume that is the end of the story.
NPR's Tamara Keith joining us from across the street from President Trump's golf course in West Palm Beach, Florida. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We just heard about President Trump's efforts to get universities to comply with his agenda. But that's not the only way he's trying to influence education in the U.S. Last week, President Trump said he wanted to, quote, return our students to the states, and signed an executive action to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. What effect could this have on K-12 and higher education across the country? And for that, we've called former Department of Education Secretary John B. King, Jr. He served under President Obama and is now the chancellor of the State University of New York, or SUNY. Chancellor King, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks so much.
We are going to get to the Department of Ed stuff in a minute, but first, I would really like to ask you about this. Federal immigration agents have arrested students at several universities now. Columbia, Georgetown, Tufts, just to name a few. Many were involved in pro-Palestinian activism. How do you respond to these events?
It's deeply troubling. Look, we have a commitment in the United States to the First Amendment and to ensuring people have an opportunity to express their views, even if they're views that we find distasteful. And folks need to be able to do that while they are studying at American universities, and they shouldn't have to live in fear around expressing their views about politics or foreign policy.
How have these arrests changed your schools? Does something stick out to you?
You know, it just created a climate of fear. And I think ultimately that's one of the tragedies here, is that we want our universities, all universities in the United States, to be places where there's robust discourse about ideas, tough conversations about areas of disagreement. And you don't want people to be afraid to speak up, and you don't want people to be afraid to come to the United States to study.
Yeah, how have your peers reacted to this? When you've spoken to other university leaders, what are they telling you? What are you all talking about?
Look, everyone's worried, worried about the attacks on federal research, which again has helped build the country's economy, helped make us the envy of the world because of our innovation economy. And so the efforts to cut federal investments in the National Institutes of Health, to cut federal investments in the preparation of teachers, that's very disturbing and undermines our work. People are very worried about the federal student aid system.
Yeah.
The layoffs at the Education Department threaten that system.
Now, the Department of Ed, it still stands. It cannot be officially closed without the approval of Congress, but between the layoffs and the departures, it is about half the size as it was when Trump took office. When you look at the places where the cuts have happened, what do you make of that?
Two of the things I'm most worried about. One, a breakdown of the federal financial aid system. The free application for federal student aid is the gateway.
Oh, FAFSA.
To access
I remember them from
FAFSA.
My college
exactly.
days. Yes.
Exactly. It's the gateway to accessing the Pell Grant program, federal student aid, as well as in many cases state.
Pell Grant, of course, are subsidies that students get to pay for college.
That's exactly right. And it's made the American dream possible for generations of low-income students. But if the FAFSA breaks, if the financial aid system is unreliable, you're undermining the entirety of public higher education. About half of our entering students are Pell-eligible students.
Wow.
If they're not able to access that aid, they won't be able to go to college. The other area I'm very worried about is the Office for Civil Rights. That's where you go if you're experiencing discrimination on the basis of race or gender or disability. They got 20,000 complaints, more than 20,000 complaints last year. Who's going to handle that with so many fewer employees?
So what do you make of the fact that the Trump administration is blaming the department for low math and reading scores since the pandemic?
That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, the reality is we need the department to provide leadership in this moment. Student performance is below where it was before COVID. We ought to be talking about things like intensive tutoring, which we know works in helping students make up ground. We ought to be talking about the national crisis of chronic absenteeism. And instead, we're talking about the dismantling of the department. It's a distraction.
Mm. I mean, much of what the Trump administration and Education Secretary Linda McMahon are trying to do here is expand school choice. So their ideas include, you know, private school vouchers, other school choice initiatives. If you were to imagine that truly coming to pass, expanded school choice, how would that transform education in the U.S.?
I'm really worried about the administration's advocacy for vouchers. The evidence is that vouchers do not help to improve student performance, but they do undermine the role of public education as a culture-building, democracy-building institution. So I'm worried about that. I'm worried that in rural communities, vouchers make no sense because there really aren't a supply of private schools that students could attend. And so you may end up taking resources away from vulnerable rural schools without really offering anything substantive to help students there.
So what does that future look like for students?
Well, when those funding cuts happen, the result is teacher layoffs. It's less opportunity for the students who are attending public schools. And that undermines the long-term health of our economy and our long-term national security.
That is John B. King Jr., former education secretary and now the chancellor of the State University of New York. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
NPR reached out to the Department of Education for comment. And a spokesperson pointed us to a written statement by Acting Undersecretary of Education James Bergeron. It reads, quote, "I want to assure you that continuity of operations for federal student aid is both a statutory and critical function of the department. Accordingly, no employees working on core functions of the free application for federal student aid or student loan servicing were impacted by the reduction in force." He added, quote, "Eliminating red tape and bureaucratic barriers imposed by the department will provide more opportunities for state and institutional leaders to innovate and best serve their students." You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The death toll in Southeast Asia from the magnitude 7.7 earthquake yesterday continues to rise. At least 1,600 people were killed in Myanmar and thousands have been injured. And that country's military-led government is now asking for international assistance following the powerful quake as scores of buildings were reduced to rubble and the quake led to a collapse of a skyscraper under construction in Bangkok. The U.S. is warning Americans not to travel to Syria. Muslim rebels are trying to stabilize the country after ousting the dictator last year. The State Department says there is a potential for imminent attacks against American citizens. And in women's college basketball, South Carolina beat Maryland last night in the Sweet 16 NCAA Championship. South Carolina plays Duke tomorrow. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Emily Kwong. Every month, NPR reporter Brian Mann checks a grim statistic, the federal tally of overdose deaths across the country. For years, that number only went up. But toward the end of 2023,
suddenly the data coming out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed this drop.
Maybe it was a fluke. But the next month, same thing.
1 month, 2 months in a row, a drop. 3 months.
Brian also started hearing the same thing from sources on the street. Like this man, Kevin Donaldson, who was using fentanyl and xylazine in Burlington, Vermont.
For a while there, we were hearing about it every other day. But when was the last overdose we heard about? A couple weeks ago, maybe? That's pretty far and few between.
What I was hearing from people using drugs on the street, talking to frontline harm reduction people, listening to people in Washington looking at this, they were saying, this feels different. The carnage feels like it's easing. Suddenly, there was a shift.
Across the country, the number of overdose deaths has continued to drop to this day.
This is a science fiction level event, like never before in the history of America's drug crisis. And this goes even back before the pain pill crisis of the 90s. Go back to heroin, go back to crack cocaine. We've never solved a drug epidemic in the way that these numbers suggest. The best interventions, with everybody throwing everything at the problem, sometimes can ease the problem by 8-9%. We're now seeing states where drug deaths are dropping 50% in a single year. 30%, 40% is now common. That level of decline. So many lives being saved.
Today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, we're going to unravel the mystery of this rapid reversal with Brian, who is NPR's addiction correspondent. All Things Considered co-host Scott Detrow picks up the conversation from here to talk about the reasons behind this surprising public health victory.
Well, walk us through some of the biggest theories. What are the thoughts as to why this is happening?
Okay, so I want to talk about the hopeful, happy parts in just a second, but let me begin with some of the maybe darker reasons this could be happening. So one thing is that a lot of people have died, Scott. I mean, this has been bad. Like, this has been terrifying. 114,000 people in 1 year, 110,000 in another year. So a lot of the most vulnerable people are gone, and that's certainly some part of it. Another thing that's happening is that people on the streets regularly tell me that they've learned how to use fentanyl, this really dangerous drug, more safely. Not safely, I don't want to sugarcoat this again, but they're better.
Incredibly dangerous.
They don't
yeah.
use it as carelessly as they used to. And so some people who are still in very severe, very unhealthy addiction to this toxic drug are surviving. They're living longer. And that is a good thing because it means they have more chances to recover, more chances to get out of this cycle. I don't want to say that they've recovered or they're healthy or they're off the street. They're still in a really dark place.
Okay, so that is the dark side of this. Talk me through some of the more positive thinking here, some of the policy-related factors that could be going on.
Yeah, and I think the data here is really strong, that we have seen one of the most effective public policy responses to a health crisis in U.S. history, right? So what the Biden administration did, they came in after a year when drug deaths had spiked 30%. That's what happened in the last year of the Trump administration. They inherit a raging, burning crisis of death across the country, and they immediately begin implementing really significant changes. First of all, they work to get naloxone, that medication that reverses overdoses. Mm-hmm. They really push to get that out on the street, get it everywhere. They just flooded the field with naloxone and Narcan, and I find it now everywhere. And I want to introduce you to Scout Gilson. She actually works now as a harm reduction person in Philadelphia, but she was on the street. She was a fentanyl user. She talks about what it was like before the Biden team made naloxone really readily available.
I remember having to decide if I was going to give somebody enough Narcan and realizing that might mean I don't have any more because I don't know how to access it. Someone else might die.
Wow.
That kind of calculation, Scott, was happening every day on every street in America. People were thinking, do I help that person survive or do I save it for myself? And now that's not what it's like. Everybody has Narcan. There's also a whole range of other things, much of it funded by the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, that made insurance coverage really widely available for people who need addiction treatment. Mm-hmm. They also made it really easy comparatively to get buprenorphine and methadone. These are medications that help people avoid relapses into fentanyl use. All of those things hitting the field at the same time, the Biden team inherits a 30% increase in drug deaths. As they left the White House, drug deaths were dropping by about 25%. So that's the arc that they managed to pull off in 4 years.
And you've now mentioned kind of the black hole of politics that just about every conversation veers its way into. So let's get into that, because you are talking about this incredibly positive track record on an issue a lot of Americans are worried about and care about. And yet, I closely covered the campaign. This is not an area where the Biden administration seemed to really tell a high-profile good news story or get a lot of credit, seemingly, at least as a top-level issue. Why do you think that was? What did you see when you saw this play out in the campaign?
It was really powerful to watch as a journalist. On the one hand, Scott, day after day, I was seeing this data solidify, showing this public health victory, this policy victory. And then what I would do is turn on the radio and I would hear Kamala Harris, the vice president and the candidate, talking about fentanyl as if it's sort of a problem that they can't really deal with. At one point in the debate with Trump, she referenced the fact that he and his political allies had torpedoed an effort to increase security, including drug security, on the southern border. Here she is.
It would have allowed us to stem the flow of fentanyl coming into the United States. I know there are so many families watching tonight who have been personally affected by the surge of fentanyl in our country.
Meanwhile, let me pivot and give you a taste of how then-candidate Trump was talking about this. Here he is out on the campaign trail.
I will stop the drugs and fentanyl pouring into our country, killing our kids and our families. We will stop it. I had it down to the lowest number in 32 years. And then these people took over, and what happened to our border? What happened to even the drugs pouring in times nine, they tell me, is nine times more than we had.
And what now President Trump was saying there on the campaign trail is just not factual. You know, fentanyl was spreading rapidly in the U.S. during his first term. Drug deaths, as we've mentioned, were skyrocketing. And yet he was clearly the one with the more powerful message leading up to the election day.
I want to ask about you and how you think about this, because you cover a lot of different topics. You've covered wars for us. You've covered the Olympics for us. You have this whole subgenre of Brian Mann pieces where you go for a hike and make people very jealous listening to you going on a hike on the radio. But you keep coming back to this topic that's a really tough topic to think about and talk about. What's the draw for you?
You know, addiction destroyed my family. I have a beloved stepbrother who I grew up with, Rick, who, you know, got drawn into the prescription pain epidemic and eventually died from complications relating to his addiction. My father was deep in addiction for much of my childhood and much of my adult life. And the thing that's really has been powerful for me is that I didn't understand any of that. I was like most Americans, I think. I had deep stigma about it. I hated it. I was scared of it. And only when I started understanding that there are treatments, there are really good medical-based, science-based ways of helping people recover, did I start to put those pieces together. And I have huge regret about how I thought about my own family, how I navigated my own life before getting into this. And so I do try to say to people that this addiction thing that is so scary and often ugly, frankly, it is also something that does respond to policy. It does respond to healthcare and science. Data is really crystal clear that if you help people stay alive long enough, by overwhelming margins, they recover, they get healthy again, they go on with really good lives. I didn't know enough about that in my own family to help get to those places. I turned away from it, honestly. And so that is a reason that I continue to be very loyal to this beat and this subject, because I love the idea that bit by bit, more Americans are realizing there is another side to this story and another side to how we respond to this.
That is NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann. Brian, thanks for helping us understand these trends and helping us understand how you approach the story.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
From painting over Washington, D.C.'s Black Lives Matter mural to temporarily scrubbing the stories of Navajo code talkers in World War II from federal websites, scholars and activists say stories of non-white history, even recent history, are being erased at rapid speed. NPR's Sandhya Dirks reports.
Kiana Jones says it hurt seeing the jackhammers dig up the yellow concrete that she had painted with the words, Black Lives Matter.
When you're down there and literally hearing and feeling the street being torn up, seeing like literally the paint being pushed to the side.
5 years ago, after the police killing of George Floyd, Jones was one of the artists who came out to paint in the middle of the night. She says watching the mural's removal felt like watching an attempt to erase the racial justice movement that arose out of grief over Floyd's killing.
It was surreal, if nothing else.
Jones says there's always been this kind of erasure, but now it's supercharged. The Department of Defense, for example, has been scrubbing websites for images and articles they equate with diversity, equity, and inclusion. A page about the military career of baseball great Jackie Robinson was erased and then restored after pushback, as a few others have been. Don Moynihan, a political scientist at the University of Michigan, says many pages and pictures, like on Arlington National Cemetery's website, are just gone. He says the Pentagon tells the larger story of defending America through individual tales of heroism.
If you take away pictures of women, if you take away pictures of Black heroes, of Asians, of Native Americans, of Latinos, then who's left?
It sends a message that only white men belong, he says. Moynihan points to the erasing of articles about the Navajo code talkers who used their native language to create an unbreakable code in World War II. The DOD has restored those pages, but Zani Gorman, whose father was a code talker, says even the temporary erasure feels scary.
I mean, I'm still kind of in a state of shock.
Gorman says Native Americans have a long history of being erased. When her father and the other code talkers were kids, they were sent to federal boarding schools.
Where they were systematically attempting to destroy our language and our culture. And the irony, right, that that same government would turn around during World War II and say, hey, gee, well, you know, can you use your language and help us win this war?
She says the code talker's story is proof that diversity makes us stronger. But that contradicts the message coming from Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, a former Fox News host. Here he is in February talking to Pentagon staff.
I think the single dumbest phrase in military history is our diversity is our strength. I think our strength is our unity.
Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale, whose most recent book is titled Erasing History, says it isn't unifying to ban these histories. He says recent history is also being erased. He, too, points to the Black Lives Matter mural. It's not just about getting rid of a painting, he says, but an attempt to paint over evidence of a movement that brought people across the world out onto the streets.
We supposedly all coalesced as a country around
finally trying to address structural racism. And there are symbols representing this kind of agreement.
Erase the symbols, break the agreement, he says. Janelle Austin is the lead caretaker of George Floyd Square in Minneapolis, a place that became a spontaneous memorial for Floyd. She says her community built the space on its own with no federal funds for a reason.
We need to be able to tell the story as it happened, because again, racism exists to misremember and disremember story.
Which is why she says historically marginalized communities have always found ways to tell their own stories in the face of erasure. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. The Trump administration has forced out the top vaccine regulator at the Food and Drug Administration. And on the way out, Dr. Peter Marks delivered scathing criticism of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. NPR Health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now with the details. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Emily.
All right, let us start with who the FDA official is that we're talking about here.
Yes, as you said, his name is Dr. Peter Marks, and he may not be a household name, but he's a big deal in the medical world. He led the FDA's powerful Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research under both Presidents Trump and Biden, regulating everything from cutting-edge gene therapies to vaccines. In fact, he played a huge role in President Trump's Operation Warp Speed, which produced the COVID-19 vaccines. And as we know, those vaccines are credited with saving many lives, but they also became very polarizing. And late Friday, Marks revealed that he'd been forced out of the FDA. NPR obtained a copy of his resignation letter, which, as you said, contained scathing criticism of his new boss, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It's an extraordinary rebuke.
What did Mark say?
Dr. Marks made it clear that while he tried to work with Kennedy, he just couldn't do it because of the secretary's views about vaccines. Let me read a little of what Dr. Marks says in his resignation letter. Quote, "It has become clear that truth and transparency are not desired by the secretary, but rather he wishes subservient confirmation of his misinformation and lies." In particular, Marks says he's worried because the nation is fighting a big outbreak of measles in Texas and elsewhere. Kennedy has been promoting alternative treatments for measles, and Mark says Kennedy is undermining confidence in safe and effective vaccines and is, quote, "irresponsible, detrimental to public health, and a clear danger to our nation's health, safety, and security."
Rob, this isn't the only move the new administration has taken about vaccines, right?
That's right. Mark's departure is just the latest high-ranking government scientist to be forced out by the Trump administration. And this comes in the midst of a series of steps Kennedy has taken that has set off alarm bells among public health experts. Kennedy has postponed or canceled important meetings by independent vaccine advisors to the CDC and FDA. He's canceled NIH grants for vaccine research. And he just tapped a well-known anti-vaccine advocate to conduct yet another study of vaccines in autism, even though that link has been debunked.
Rob, what have been the reactions to Dr. Mark's departure?
You know, I have to say it's been dismay that's been pouring in from medical experts around the country. I talked today with Dr. Paul Offit. He's a vaccine expert at the University of Pennsylvania who served for years as an FDA advisor and sometimes clashed with Mark's. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
I give Peter Mark's credit. I think he was unwilling to bend a knee to RFK Jr.'s misinformation campaign. And now, I think with Peter Marks gone, it's like the fox guarding the hen house. This is a sad day for America's children.
What does the administration have to say?
An HHS official released a statement that says if Marks, quote, "does not want to get behind restoring science to its golden standard and promoting radical transparency, then he has no place at FDA under the strong leadership of Secretary Kennedy," unquote.
That is NPR Health correspondent Rob Stein. Thanks, Rob.
You bet, Emily.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
With the U.S. southern border effectively closed, some Latin American migrants are deciding to return home.
It will be just like a waterfall. People come from Guatemala to Nicaragua to El Salvador to Costa Rica to Panama.
But is Panama ready to handle a wave of reverse migration? That story and the latest political news Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A federal judge in Boston has temporarily halted the deportation of a Turkish doctoral student at Tufts University. She's one of several students and protesters who have had their visas revoked by the Trump administration. Firefighters in the Carolinas continue to battle wildfires. Gusty winds, low humidity, and dry vegetation are fueling the blazes. In South Carolina, the huge Table Rock fire is one of several burning and is not contained so far. And the FAA says it's investigating yesterday's close call between a Delta flight and a U.S. Air Force jet at Reagan National Airport outside Washington, D.C. In late January, a collision between an American Airlines flight and an Army helicopter at that airport killed 67 people. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Emily Kwong. So listen, when I was a kid, I loved going to the grocery store, and it was entirely to ride around on the back of a shopping cart. But the modern shopping cart, as we know it, didn't always exist, which meant it had to be invented. How Curious is a podcast from KGOU out of Norman, Oklahoma, that explores the state's legends, tall tales, and other stories. So when listener and Oklahoma patent attorney Martin Ozinga asked, "Was the shopping cart invented in Oklahoma?" host Rachel Hopkin decided to investigate. And the story starts with businessman Sylvan Goldman, the man usually credited with the shopping cart's invention.
You thought there'd always been a shopping cart, didn't you? Not until Sylvan N. Goldman invented it, there wasn't.
CBS reporter Charles Kuraut interviewed Sylvan Goldman back in 1977.
Well, I thought if Adam and Eve had a shopping cart, they'd always been in use.
Not at all. And for a long while, there was no need for one, since before cars, people could only buy what they were able to carry home. Alison Atchison is the director of galleries and collections at Science Museum Oklahoma, which has quite a few items in its collection relating to Sylvan Goldman.
He was born in 1898 in Indian Territory. It later became Ardmore. And he served in World War I, came back, he and his brother went off to California. They ran into the first supermarkets over in California. They came back and started to develop supermarkets in the Tulsa area.
Later on, they moved their focus to Oklahoma City and environs. This was during the Great Depression, and Sylvan was constantly looking for ways to increase profits.
He would watch people shop, and he noticed they stopped shopping when they couldn't carry anything more. So he went up to his office one evening, was really thinking about it, and he grabbed a chair and worked with Fred Young, a mechanic in the shop, and they came up with a prototype.
Allison brought out an example of that very first cart, and it didn't look very much like the carts we're used to using today.
I can actually describe what he did. It was a folding chair. He put wheels on the 4 feet and then a basket on the seat, and then he put a platform on the things that kept the legs together, and that held another basket too, so it was a two-layer of baskets.
The walls of Sylvan N. Goldman's office are bright with cartoon tributes to his invention. Tributes to him, really.
Charles Kuratget, who evidently was not one to stint on blandishments.
The Newton of the A&P, the Edison of the Kmart, the original genius who made possible life as we know it today.
I notice this. It says, shoppers came and saw and said it's a wow. Is that really what happened?
No. That's a big lie.
It was. Although Sylvan Goldman was delighted with his invention, customers proved less than enthusiastic.
No one wanted them. Women said, once my baby's out of the stroller, I don't want to push a cart around anymore. I'm done. Men thought that they were effeminate. Well, Sylvan, he hired models to walk around his stores with the carts. So good-looking people.
Men and women?
Men and women.
Okay.
The book is How the Shopping Cart Explains Global Consumerism.
Its author is American Studies Professor Andrew Warnes, who's based at the University of Leeds.
Before Sylvan Goldman comes along and popularizes the shopping cart, shoppers are basically limited to what they can carry. So the cart, you know, the idea that Goldman invented it, well, carts have been around for centuries, for millennia, before Goldman. But what he realizes is that there's something he can patent and there's something he can popularize that actually takes that weight off of shoppers and allows them to glide through the store and transport things with relative ease to the trunks of their cars.
The rise in automobile use and the increasingly widespread ownership of fridges and freezers were both crucial to the success of the cart, which in turn led to a thriving business in package design.
Suddenly you've got a kind of ability to design the commodity as something that can be quickly grabbed, scooped, dumped in the cart, move on to the next thing. So the kind of proliferation of impulse buys happens. So I do think it's really important in transforming the way we shop.
Back at Science Museum, Oklahoma, Allison took me to see a bronze statue of Sylvan Goldman in which he's depicted standing alongside a shopping cart.
So it says, Sylvan N. Goldman, 1898 to 1984, inventor of the shopping cart that changed the world. Oh, and look, there's actually some things in the shopping trolley. So there's a carton, which could be milk, an egg box, a bunch of celery, and cereal. That's so funny. I just thought that somebody had thrown some stuff in there to keep it there. I didn't realize that was part of the display.
No, it's bronze.
Goldman's family commissioned the Oklahoma sculptor Lena Beth Fraser to create this piece in 1985, the year after Goldman died.
I just think it's interesting that they did choose the nesting one, you know, instead of the prototype one, to be commemorated with him.
Okay, so this is where it gets rather complicated. Sylvan Goldman certainly invented a shopping cart, the one based on the folding chair with two baskets. But although that creation doubled the size of things one can purchase during a single trip, it had drawbacks, not the least of which was that when all set up with baskets in place, it took up a lot of floor space.
That's when Orla Watson got the idea for a nesting shopping cart, which is much more like the ones that you see today. And he applied for the patent for the nesting shopping cart. And Sylvan Goldman interrupted it, and he applied for his own patent for a nesting shopping cart.
Do we know if he actually had been designing a nesting shopping cart, or was he jumping on a bandwagon?
Right.
Yes.
I don't know.
As generally happens with new inventions, they get modified and streamlined over time, thanks to multiple interventions. Here, it seems like the person we have to thank for the crucial innovation that allowed carts to nest, namely the rear swinging gate, was down to a Kansas City inventor called Orla Watson. Watson began testing his product in a couple of local stores, but his progress was hampered by problems in production. In the meantime, and as Allison just said, Goldman, who could easily have paid a visit to one of those test stores, filed a patent for his own, and some might say suspiciously similar, nesting cart. This resulted in much back and forth between the two parties, some of it quite bitter. But in the end, a compromise was reached. Watson received the patent for the telescoping shopping cart, but granted Goldman a license to produce and commercialize it. In any case, let's leave the final word to Silvan Goldman himself, as interviewed in 1977 by CBS reporter Charles Curout.
What would our country be like if you'd never invented the shopping cart?
Oh, I'll tell you, it'd be just like it is now because somebody else would have.
Rachel Hopkin hosts the How Curious podcast for KGOU Public Radio in Norman, Oklahoma, which explores the Sooner State's legends, tall tales, and other stories from its past and present. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, so I know springtime is the season of flowers, but it is also a time for new music. I'm talking about album releases from artists having a breakthrough moment or those just trying something new. So we're joined by NPR music critic Ann Powers to talk about three artists who are making an impression at different phases of their careers. Ann, hi.
Hey, Emily. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Ann, so there are a lot of artists releasing music right now. Not huge pop stars, but ones with like an avid following who are making long careers for themselves. I'm thinking of Lucy Dacus, who's getting a lot of attention right now, or even a band like Mumford & Sons. What records did you pick to bring us along these lines?
Well, Emily, I brought three albums from artists who are at different points in their life's journey. As it happens, one is 33, one is 43, and one is 53. So we're kind of like...
We love numerical symmetry. We love numerical meaning, yes.
We're moving through the seasons of life, appropriate for spring, right? But let's start with the youngest artist, Cristia Cabral. She records under the name Spelling. That's Spelling misspelled with three L's in the middle of it. I've been a fan of Spelling since 2021 when she put out her fantastic album, The Turning Wheel. But Cristia is back now with Portrait of My Heart. That's her new album. And man, she has really grown. She has grown into her voice. The sound of this album is just huge. And I feel like it could be a breakthrough. I mean, like, seriously, I want to put her on a stage with Chapel Roan this summer. Huh. I want her out there. I think she deserves it.
That would be, let's manifest that for Spelling. And listen to one of her songs. Which one do you want to hear?
Let's hear Alibi. I think it really gives a great sense of the vibe on this, which almost gives me, like, I don't know, Pat Benatar feelings.
Oh yeah, you can definitely hear a kind of Pat Benatar energy.
Right. Like a operatic arena rock feeling. And that, you know, that song has that great big guitar riff. Played by Pat McCrory, who is a member of Turnstile, which is, I don't know, maybe the biggest hardcore band out there. But the Spelling goes a lot of places on this record. She also has a bit of an R&B feel on some of the songs. Just really expanded her sound, and I really love that.
Another longtime indie favorite you've brought us is Perfume Genius. He's
yes.
releasing his seventh album this week. You're a longtime fan of Mike Hadrius, the musician behind this project. What do you hear in his new album, which is called Glory?
Well, you know, I luxuriate in the music of Perfume Genius. It's huge, it's decadent, it's complicated, it's sometimes even feels cruel. The intensity of his songs and his delivery have really drawn me in over the years. But on this album, he does something different, which is that instead of working mostly in isolation or with his partner, Alan Weifels, he actually worked with a band in the studio, and it really expands and just like enriches the Perfume Genius sound. You can really hear it on the song Full On.
Okay, Hadrius is 43 now, and he really made a name for himself singing about loneliness, about isolation in these very honest ways that won him a wide fan base. What does playing with a band do for him?
Yeah, well, he's still doing these little vignettes, creating these character studies that are mysterious and a little weird. Like, you don't always know what's happening in a Perfume Genius song. But the bigger sonic palette on this album lets Mike build out his scenes more richly. And I'm particularly struck by the way the bigger sound frames his voice. Like, his voice has never sounded as beautiful as it does on these tracks. Folded on my lap.
Third selection you've brought us is a very different kind of album. It's a new one from a reunited Alison Krauss and Union Station. And the samples from the two albums we just heard are very maximalist, very pushing the boundaries of indie rock. I kind of think of Alison Krauss as the opposite. She's a very quiet singer with an elegant stripped down sound. Has that changed?
Well, I mean, I actually brought this album in, Emily, partly to make an argument about Alison Krauss in general, which is that even though we know her as this very tasteful artist, you know, who made these beautiful soundtracks for your lovely dinner, you know, like the soundtrack to Cold Mountain, or
Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Right, I had that on repeat or in high school.
Right, or the work she did with Robert Plant, right?
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff, but sort of maybe you often hear it in the background. But working with her longtime band, Union Station, with whom she's reunited here, we can hear her roots in bluegrass, and honestly, it's just a huge record in its own way. It's going to really sweep you away if you let it.
There has been a big change in the band too, right, in Union Station?
Yes. I mean, Union Station still has these incredible virtuoso players like Jerry Douglas on the dobro and Ron Block on the banjo, but Dan Tominski, who was Allison's co-vocalist in the band, he didn't sign up for this reunion. Instead, they've enlisted a guy named Russell Moore. He's from a much-loved bluegrass band called Third Time Out. Hmm. And now Moore has this big, sharp voice that's like classic high lonesome kind of bluegrass voice. And the songs he takes lead on intensify the impact of this album. He sings a song that I absolutely love. It's called Northside Gal. It's by an artist named J.D. McPherson originally. In J.D.'s version, it's rockabilly, but check out what happens to it when Union Station performs it. I've got some good talk, but not enough game. Ooh, it a sweet thing. Oh, ain't it a shame? Every time I try, crazy about a Northside Gal. It's fun, right? That's
yeah.
Very up-tempo and fun, you know, but you
really
can still
fun.
Like sink into it.
That's Ann Powers, NPR music critic. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
So easy to live, so easy to idolize. Others above, so worth the yearning for. So swell to keep every warmth I burn for. We'd be so grand at the game, so carefree together, that it does seem a shame that you can't see your future with me, 'cause you feel so